This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
My talk is about misbehaving wastes of late modernity and how they confuse relationships between human beings and our environments. Even after it's been consigned to a truck, rejectamenta continues to assert itself. It's rebellious, this refuse, and it can cause very unsettling disruptions. I take this idea in part from two works by China Mieville. One is a novel called Un London, in which a small key character is a piece of feral trash, which follows the main character around. And then also in his magisterial work, Perdido Street Station, he crafts a golem from scrap, who is a pivotal character in the conclusion of that book. So with that as our framework, I'm going to tell two stories, one about an accidental archaeology and the other about an inadvertent museum. So we're going to start in New York. And these two, the inadvertent museum is the Molina Collection, and the accidental archaeology is Dead Horse Bay, and that's where we'll begin. These two maps show the fascinating history of this particular landscape. The older map on the top from 1874 shows the collection of islands and disconnected lands, whereas the contemporary map on the bottom is its current shape. So it's gone from fragments to something solid, but as I will show you, it is not, in fact, solid. This is a close-up of where we're going to focus our attention right now. If you take the number 5 train to the end of the line and then the Q35 bus to the last stop before the bridge and get off and walk to your right, you will eventually come to the water. On your way, you may realize that there are pieces of material that are asserting themselves into the world from the ground, because the ground is a very shallow cover for the fill that glued all of those islands together. This is a hubcap that this particular fellow found just on the way to the beach. When you actually see the water for the first time, you come over a little crest, and then there you are on the beach. I'm just going to read a few paragraphs here to give you a sense of what that is. Only a thin and littered strip of beach shows at high tide. At first, it seems an unremarkable slice of forgotten sand, nondescript, sloping gently down from the ragged banks of shrubs and grasses and low trees that stands behind it. But countless shards of dark glass and rings of bone worn to the color of wood suggest deeper secrets. As the tide recedes, the beach slowly reveals its glittering and unlikely excess. Shallow waters are thick with old bottles and bottle fragments, pieces of china and porcelain and pottery, remnants of toothbrushes and shaving brushes and hair brushes, vinyl squeeze containers of spray deodorant with names like Odorono and Stopette. There's blood red nail polish still in its bottles, linoleum flooring, shower curtains, roller skates, dentures, car parts, eyeglasses, doorknobs, electrical fixtures, light bulbs. These are the hauntings of Brooklyn's Dead Horse Bay, once home to the world's largest concentration of rendering facilities. Some of you know what those are. For those of you who don't, that's where the carcasses of large animals were turned into saleable commodities. The saying was you could use everything of the horse except the whinny. It was later the dumping ground for haphazardly collected and carelessly buried ruins, but the Noxema and milk of magnesia and Clorox bottles, the seamed stockings, the leaf springs, the clothing irons, the shoes, so many shoes, aren't discards. They were never thrown away. Rather, they were left behind. Families forced from their homes in the city's frenzy of urban renewal and highway building projects in the 1950s abandoned these now jumbled, barnacled bed frames and ash cans and push mowers and frying pans, the mundane goods that adorned their days, and then were lost. Now these objects adorn a V-shaped beach on Jamaica Bay, unexamined artifacts that speak eloquently of an era not so far in the past, but so different from our own. Another way to think about this, and I explain this to students when we go on tours, imagine you're a props master for a 1950s film about working class Brooklyn, and your job is to fill their homes with all the objects that would have been a part of their world. Then take that entire enterprise and dump it into a series of collection trucks, and I will speak in a moment a little bit more about what is a collection truck. You all call it a garbage truck. And then take all of that to an expansive saltwater harbor, dump it along the shore, cover it with a shallow layer of dirt, walk away, and wait a few decades. The result would be what you find today at Dead Horse Bay. So it's a form of urban self-creation. This was in the heyday of Robert Moses' urban highway building era. And it's also simultaneously a profound destruction. And ironically, The top layer, which is what most of these finds come from, was deposited somewhere between early February and mid-March of 1953. And landfill technology was already far more sophisticated then than just dumping and running. I don't know why the city made this choice, but because of this choice, we get to pull dentures off the beach. One of the characteristics of waste is that it's talked about with the same language used for water. So waste management professionals talk about waste sheds and waste streams. Like Melody's talk earlier today, the notion of fluidity is absolutely essential in the world of waste. And like the essay by Tim Ingold, the problem of leakiness is perpetual when it comes to garbage. Also, referring back to Melody's talk, there's a place, it's here, along the edge of the beach that I've always called the cut. It's where water and wind and time and the sloppy construction of the landfill gives way to a perpetual carving, an excavation, a revelation, a redemption, and the continuous regurgitation of materials that we assumed were inert and gone, but that are continuing to move in the world. All of this calls to mind some of the writing of Italo Calvino, his work in invisible cities, particularly a few different cities, but particularly Ionia, where the residents outfit themselves and furnish their homes with new commodities every morning, having thrown out all the old stuff the night before. And so their identities are always shiny and sparkling, but they are surrounding themselves with ever taller mountains, ringing the town with ever taller mountains of waste. And in his essay, La Poubelle Agréée, he makes the point that we don't know who we are until we look at what we've thrown out and then assess ourselves based on what's left behind. And then we understand our identity and our place in the world and our relationships with each other. That all becomes troublesome when we realize that everything is future trash. All that is solid is only ephemeral. If objects are imbued with meaning, their haphazard and unintentional dispersal on a beach on a distant edge of a grand city suggests that the meaning is as ephemeral as the things themselves. When I take people to Dead Horse Bay and they walk the beach, you see them curious and then deeply puzzled and then very, very confused. Sometimes there's avarice. There was a woman who said, when I take people to Dead Horse Bay, I ask them not to take anything off the beach, although I may change my position on that. And one woman said, I want to take something so badly it makes my eyes hurt. So, okay. Does anyone recognize this? Some of you my age will know what this is. I'm sure it was the model for R2-D2. But younger people tend not to know what this is. I see nodding. This is a juicer. You put the cup underneath where the hollow is, and you have an upside-down orange on the top, and you pull the lid down, and then you squeeze the handle on the side. You can still find them, but they're kind of rare. I took a student here once who was in my class about discard studies, And he only signed up for the class because it fit his schedule, and he knew it was a ridiculous subject to have an entire semester about, and oh my God, what was wrong with this stupid university? And we went to Dead Horse Bay, and after about a half an hour, he came to me and he said, I get it. Now I understand. Seeing these kinds of remnants and pieces, did you know we used to have hormones in our shampoo? And can you see what this is? It's a little hard to discern. Clothing iron, right? Zygmunt Bauman, the sociologist, says in writing about liquid modernity, everything is born with a branding of imminent death. Liquid modernity is a civilization of excess, redundancy, waste, and waste disposal. And Frederick Jameson, complementing this kind of thought, talks about the fragmented and schizophrenic decentering and dispersion of the subject. And one of the reasons that the final emotion that Dead Horse Bay evokes in people who walk it for more than just a few minutes is a feeling of sorrow, because there's something quite haunted about this particular geography and about these material goods that perhaps they were never formally designated as relics we would want to pass on to our children and our grandchildren, but they were certainly not intended to be strewn about a beach where anonymous future people could walk and guess and try and sense who owned that nail polish bottle and the hairbrushes and the linoleum. This is the anthropologist Emily Martin. We went out there a few years ago. In fact, this was in 2010. And I include this slide just to really underscore the erosion of this place. That's the same tree that she's standing next to. And again, the same tree. So it's very much a constant process of the wind and the water pulling the objects out of the depository that is the landfill. This is a nice informal inventory that some students of mine pulled together after walking the beach a couple of years ago. And this is how close it is to the city. It's really within, not a stone's throw exactly, but it's not far from Lower Manhattan. This boat isn't there anymore, but the quote is lovely. So now we're going to go back to our second location. Just to remind you what that is, the Molina Collection is on the Upper East Side. It's the Spanish Harlem neighborhood of Manhattan. I'm one of the few people who calls it the Molina Collection for reasons I'll make clear in a moment. Everyone else calls it the Manhattan 11 Sanitation Garage, which it also is. Nelson is a retired sanitation worker. I'm just taking you into the garage now. We're going to go inside, and then we're going to go upstairs. Nelson was born and raised in this neighborhood. He worked there for his entire career, and he raised his family in this neighborhood. He's in his 60s now, and he has a passion for collecting things he finds in the trash that he feels do not deserve to be discarded. So he now has this informal gallery or assemblage of tens of thousands of objects that he's pulled out of the refuse. That's Nelson. The garage is a two-story structure built in the 1920s, and the second floor is no longer stable enough to hold the weight of the trucks, so they park outside. And once that happened, Nelson's collection exploded because he now has about 4,000 square feet. I mentioned earlier the collection truck. That's the sanitation language for a garbage truck. When you are sent out on the street to pick up garbage, it's called being on collection. If you're doing paper or plastic or metal, you're on recycling. But so when you're on collection, you are encountering the cast-offs and debris of the city. Nelson's gift is what he calls his sixth sense for knowing when to actually open a bag, when to listen to trust his sensory apparatus to investigate what might be in a given garbage bag. He's very much both Walter Benjamin's flaneur and rag picker. Both are itinerant metaphors that register the city as a text to be inscribed, read, rewritten, and reread. The flaneur walks idly through the city, listening to its narrative. The rag picker, too, moves across the urban landscape, but as a scavenger, collecting, rereading, and rewriting its history. That's a quote from Deborah Parsons' book, Street Walking the Metropolis. I will say that Nelson never walks idly through the city, even when he's out with his family in an evening going to a movie. If he has a sense that there's something worth exploring, he will stop, even though his wife will protest. So Nelson, he perambulates, he creates this perpetual collage. He's continually rearranging it and cleaning it and nurturing it. And in a sense, he's curating history. His district that he worked for his whole career is on the Upper East Side. The west half of it is some of the wealthiest zip codes in the world. It includes Fifth Avenue from 96th Street to 110th. But the east side is Spanish Harlem, so it's not at all an affluent neighborhood. And his collection reflects that wide disparity of wealth and, in some cases, true poverty. There was a group of scholars doing an NEH month-long workshop at Bard Graduate Center last year, and we walked them through the collection, and when they were done, we were having a conversation with Nelson, and an artist from Rhode Island said to Nelson, "Do you love all these objects?" And Nelson, he paused, and he looked genuinely startled by the question, and he said, "Yes." Like, he didn't say, "Duh," but implied, and he wouldn't, he's such a kind person, but implied in his tone was, of course, all of these. When people walk the space and they see what many of us consider to be inviolable categories of material culture that will never, ever end up in a garbage can, like photographs, diplomas, baptismal certificates, trophies, engraved baby spoons and caps and cups, there's a similar reaction to when people walk Dead Horse Bay, which is confusion, puzzlement, curiosity, avarice, and sorrow. Mary Douglas, kind of the grandmother of discard studies, argues that we shape the universe by imposing order on it, but of course that also requires that we define what constitutes disorder. The archaeologist Nan Rothschild points out that objects sustain the weight of and substitute for memory. Meanwhile, another archaeologist, Bill Rathje, who was the founder of the Garbage Project out in Arizona many years ago, one of his central arguments is that garbage is a highly visible problem that we choose to make invisible. Nelson's collection and Dead Horse Bay, in very different ways, insist on the visibility of this material that was consigned to where? This is where? We throw it out, garbage? We throw it, emphatically throw it out. The out is no, there's no definition for the out, but it's elsewhere, certainly elsewhere. Again, to draw on Zygmunt Bauman, he talks about forms of modern life that he claims are united by their fragility, temporariness, vulnerability, and inclination to constant change, what he's chosen to call liquid modernity. It's the growing conviction that change is the only permanence and uncertainty is the only certainty. Yesterday, Kate talked about the narrative hedge of thinking that the last male white rhino on the planet, who's now left us, that we can pull DNA and de-extinct him, and that in part prevents us from having to confront the just devastating truth that, in fact, this animal is gone. Similarly, in talking about Dead Horse Bay and the Molina collection, for Dead Horse Bay, when people are confronted with the shoes and the very intimate objects of these lives that were uprooted by Robert Moses and the city government, they pull back and say, well, no, it's garbage. It's garbage. It's not garbage. It's archaeology. It's contemporary archaeology. But it reads of us, only a few generations back, in intimate detail. And so to call it just garbage is to gloss it as something much more easily turned away from. Similarly, with the Molina collection, these are things that have been rescued, even redeemed. This is the locker room. There's no space in the second floor of this building that is not colonized, if you will, by Nelson's collection. But then the question is, do these things become sort of static or trapped? And the narrative to hedge here is, Well, who knows what's going to happen to this? And in fact, its future is up for grabs right now. But it was garbage once, so we'll just let it, if it's thrown out again, it's not such a tragedy. As it happens, there's a wonderful example of exactly this kind of issue right here in the building. Next to the door to the restroom, around the corner, is a collection from the Commercial Museum of Philadelphia, which was running from 1899 to 1994. The Sloat Foundation actually retrieved in 2010 what other museums around the city did not want. And so there's a small display and a quote from the comparative literature scholar Thomas Kinnon. There is no museum without the threat of erasure or incompletion. No museum not shadowed by the imagination of the impending destruction of what it therefore seeks to stabilize and maintain. So Dead Horse Bay does not have, those objects are not museumed yet. Nelson calls his collection the Manhattan East Garage Museum, or the Treasures in the Trash Museum. A lot of media have picked up on that. I tried to stop them from doing it because a museum in the state of New York is a chartered, formal, state-recognized organization with a lot of paperwork underneath it and very strict rules, but the genie was out of the bottle, so it is called a museum. Regina Spektor has a song called All the Rowboats. Some of you might know it. And part of the lyric says, God, I pity the violins. She's in a museum in the song. In gold coffins, they keep coughing. They've forgotten how to sing. Masterpieces serving maximum sentences. It's their own fault for being timeless. There's a price you pay and a consequence. So I want to conclude with two thoughts about time warps. To throw things out is to throw ourselves into a distant future, because that stuff is not going away. But then sometimes it doesn't stay in the future, and it instead reappears in the present as traces of the past, which then sort of gets up in our faces, warping the space-time continuum with its insistence on itself and with its stubborn solidity. Habits of thought read materiality as impermanent, even though the physical properties of much of today's material world ensure that our discards will endure far longer than the average lifespan of a human being, which is the second time warp. We haven't talked much today or yesterday about specifically plastics, but I would submit that plastics are the only slightly less toxic counterpart to nuclear waste, in that we don't actually know their half-lives. So in considering these variables and collections and anti-collections, my goal in life is to make garbage sexy. I don't think that'll ever happen for a whole lot of reasons that are related to what we've been talking about here and also a little bit separate. But if you have any thoughts about how to help that come about, I would love to hear them. And also any thoughts about other ways to play with the idea. I'm looking at the screen here to see what's coming. Ideas about these themes, some of which I've already learned today from those of you who've already spoken, but I would love to hear ideas from this extraordinary collective about these issues and anything related.